Okay, so our next session is about mindfulness and mental health, the Buddhist and the scientific approach. They're two paths, but do they lead to one destination? How does the practice of mindfulness improve physical and mental health? The Buddhist contribution to mental health through mindfulness methods will be addressed, as will new research findings on mindfulness-based stress reduction in the treatment of anxiety and depression. Our first speaker will be Dr. Norman Farb. Dr. Farb is an assistant professor in psychology at the University of Toronto at the Mississauga campus, where he directs the Regulatory and Affective Dynamics Lab. He is a fellow at the Mind and Life Institute and is a leading researcher in the neuroscience of mindfulness. Today, Dr. Farb will talk about the recent advances in mindfulness-based stress reduction and mindfulness-based cognitive therapy programs for the treatment of depression and anxiety. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Norman Farb.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction, and thank you all for being here. It's really my pleasure to be able to present a bit of our work to you today. And my goal in the next few minutes is really to try to communicate what I see as an amazing opportunity for a partnership between rich contemplative traditions and the scientific method. And I think we're really privileged, I feel privileged to live in a time where there's this sort of unparalleled openness to taking what's supposed to be the sort of like really gruff and stern scientific like authority and opening it up to actually exploring things that aren't as conventionally endorsed or enshrined in secular Western culture. So I want to sort of frame the next few minutes in terms of these three kind of questions, the first of which being, why would we want to use neuroscience? Like, if you're really a committed Buddhist or contemplative practitioner, why might you want to listen to a neuroscientist, or what can a neuroscientist do for you? Clearly there's some interest, because we have this panel today and tomorrow, and you're here. So I wanted to sort of step through some of my perspective on where that partnership can begin. And sort of lurking in the background there is also this concern of where might it not be the best to rely on neuroscience, or what are the limits, what are scientific perspectives can really speak to. I know there's probably some sensitivity in the audience to that. And I'll say right at the front of this brief lecture that in no way do I think a neuroscientific account could ever supersede or override your personal lived experience. And if someone is telling you that your lived experience is wrong because they saw this part of the brain light up, that's a good time to sort of smile and stop paying attention. but that doesn't mean that there might still be some ways that neuroscientific findings could challenge or inform your understanding or how you contextualize your personal experience. And I really think that might be kind of that middle way where we can find a partnership. And that sort of brings me to that final question. So what's practical? Like, other than showing some nice brain pictures of things lighting up and turning off and so on and so forth, can you really get anything practical out of the type of research we're doing and hoping to do? So one thing I would sort of suggest when thinking about how science can engage with contemplative practices is to think about your contemplative practices as being sort of functional processes, right? Like, so that in some ways the reason that we engage in a contemplative practice is that there is some sort of problem we're trying to solve, or some sort of project that we're undertaking. And I know there's a lot of non-striving aspects to contemplative practices, but I think it's also important to understand that there is still a deep yearning for change that's motivating these practices, and that's not the same thing as striving for a particular mental state while you're in the practice, right? There can still be a broad passion to have things change in your life and the lives of others and the world and beyond without that being equated with just like striving in wrong practice in some way. And if we can get a handle on what that broader project is, what each one of us might be up to, and it might not be the same for each person, now we start getting into the arena where science, I think, can start to play together with contemplative practices, because there's a desired sort of longitudinal outcome, even if we don't know exactly what it's going to look like or how we're going to get there. And I think that's really where neurobiology, neuroscientific accounts can offer something as opposed to trying to tell you, you know, the type of qualitative experience that you ought to be having. So just a metaphor to help me to clarify that idea, and I was told, I believe, yesterday, like, I don't know if the bumper sticker should say Mahayana on it. This is, like, mostly a Theravadan crowd. Sorry. And thanks, Philippe, for that joke. But you could think of any sort of contemplative practice as in some way being a vehicle that's supposed to get you somewhere. And if you're willing to sort of go along with me with that metaphor, there's going to be some aspects of that vehicle that are absolutely central for you to reach that destination, right? So if this is a car, you know, you're not really going to get that far without an engine, but like the cool spoiler on the back that makes people go like, ooh, wow, that car must be fast. Like that might not be as central to the mission. And depending on where you're trying to drive or what you're trying to use that vehicle for, you may have a different sort of taxonomy or understanding of what those central features are and which features are superfluous. But I would sort of pose the idea to you that it is an empirical question, what is central and what is superfluous in those features, right? Like from a scientific perspective, you could take this thing called a car, imagine you've never seen a car before, and be like, well, what happens if we take these window things off? Does it still get me there? And like, yeah, I get more like bugs in my hair, but I get there. Oh, if I take the engine out, does it work? Oh, no, it doesn't work at all then. So that's sort of the idea, and admittedly it's a crude, maybe mechanistic account of what contemplative practices might be doing, but if we can sort of hold them accountable, hold practices accountable to achieving certain outcomes, again, not necessarily in the moment of the practice, but over the course of time, of perhaps days, months, years, lifetime of practice, then we can start to ask that question, well, what are the central and what might be the more superfluous or aesthetic or cosmetic features of these practices? And I think that can be a really rich place for a conversation between someone well-versed in what the sort of contemplative standards are and this sort of scientific exploration and testing of those accounts. Right, so really boiling down to like what features affect our ability to get from A to B, and holding in mind that we may have completely different intuitions about where we want to drive. Right, and so when we study things like mindfulness-based stress reduction or mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, these are kind of secularized, 8-week, manualized clinical interventions, and the people showing up to do these courses, you know, it's in the name of the course. They're trying to get some relief from stress. They may not be trying to completely decondition their perception or liberate themselves from the chain of causality, right? So the types of questions you might ask about the efficacy of a mindfulness-based stress reduction course might be different than you would ask about what 30 years of a particular contemplative tradition is going to do. So I think there's three main areas I want to highlight where neuroscience, neurobiological accounts are particularly useful. And I think they get more pithy, more meaningful as you go down the list. So I'll start with this idea of just that they do help to support and in some ways translate or validate qualitative accounts. So you personally don't need someone to tell you that your direct experience is real. But if you're trying to convince someone else that you had this kind of experience, like, oh, I in that moment, I really felt that there was no separation between me and another person, so of course I was able, you know, to care for them despite the situation. You can be talking about this authentic story, and someone else can come back and say, well, no, I think you just wanted to look good. Like, they could try to override your account. I don't believe that there's such a thing as, like, real lack of separation between self and other. And so this is something we could actually test, right? And to the extent that we can show some sort of quantifiable evidence, especially if it's brain evidence these days, oh man, it's like nowadays if there's a brain picture, actually there are studies that literally show if you have a brain picture in a scientific article, people just believe it more. So it literally has, oh, I shouldn't say literally, it has a currency to it, right? That may help you at least begin a sincere conversation with someone who is very skeptical about the types of things that you're up to. So an example for that in my own research, probably the most famous thing that I've done so far, is we try to validate the account that I think a lot of people have, that there really is something different to be in the moment, as opposed to be ruminating, thinking, analyzing, judging, justifying experience. Like, it really feels like it's qualitatively, it's just a complete different shift, right? I don't know if it's at the level of, you know, a jhana state, but it's different to just to drop into the present. And so if that's true and it's sort of replicable, like people are getting expertise at being able to drop into the present, we should be able to observe that in terms of brain states. And so we were able to show that when we asked people in a brain scanner, in a functional MRI, to spend time judging these self-descriptive trait words, like honest, dishonest, happy, unhappy. And we contrasted that against the period of time while they're in the scanner, and we asked them just to like notice the full breadth of their experience, their body sensations, their feelings, and their thoughts. We could actually start to distinguish between those two types of states, the judging state, the analytic state, versus this kind of sensing, open, experiential state. And what's more, we found that people in general are very good at going into that kind of judging state. And in fact, if you don't ask people to do anything particular, they go into this kind of judging state. And when you ask someone who has no contemplative training to go into this kind of sensing open state, what that means for them often is just turning down the dial on that judging state a bit. So that same brain network here along the midline of the brain gets a bit quieter. But you don't see something new showing up. But when we do that same sort of paradigm with a group of people who've completed one of these 8-week mindfulness-based stress reduction classes, so they're supposed to practice about an hour a day for each of the 8 weeks. They meet once a week in a group setting to learn different practices and discuss and sort of share their experience. Well, these people could judge, as you might imagine, they didn't forget how to judge in 8 weeks, and they can turn down the judging network, but they also show the activation of this right lateralized network in the brain that accounts for representations of what's happening on the surface and inside the body, and also some prefrontal regions that might help with attentional control. And they're able to stably activate these regions even in the context of seeing these trait descriptor words. So we're able to help to validate or at least translate other people's reported experiences, being able to sort of drop into the moment and have this ongoing momentary updating of sensation that runs parallel to the thoughts that inevitably pop up, and show that with some practice, with even 8 weeks of practice, you can hold on to that state sustainably enough that we can observe it in a brain scanner. And so that opens the door now suddenly to looking at, to go to a hospital administrator or someone who's coming up with a policy decision or a funding decision and say, you know, there's something quantifiably different about these people when they go through mindfulness training, right? They're able to have more control, more flexible orientation of how they relate to their experience. That second kind of account of why neurobiology or neuroscience might be useful is that it actually helps us get beyond self-report. And I think a limitation, if I can be a little bit provocative, of just of standard contemplative practice is it's heavily reliant on self-report and insight. And so if there are things going on sort of below the surface that a person doesn't have insight to, it's very hard to measure that. But if you use these kind of brain imaging techniques, and you don't have to stop someone in the middle of some sort of rarefied state to ask them to put into words what's going on, you might actually get a more nuanced account of what's going on below the surface. And I'm going to talk about this a lot more tomorrow, but one example sort of where this is important, for instance, is when we're studying mood disorders. If you ask someone after showing them sad film clips, so we show people a few sad film clips in a row, how sad they feel, it doesn't really matter whether they've done mindfulness training or not. They'll say, I feel more and more sad as they watch more and more of these clips. Like, thanks a lot. compared to like Home and Garden television, which are those lines on the bottom. And yet the people who've done the mindfulness training are much less depressed, right? They have a higher level of well-being. So underneath this claim of feeling, you know, X amount sad, 5 out of 7 in terms of my sadness intensity, there's actually a different brain process going on that actually separates the people who've done contemplative training, a mindfulness-based stress reduction class, and those who haven't. Such that the people who are involuntarily or automatically deactivating those sensory representations, this is a picture of the insula here, which tells us what's happening inside our bodies from moment to moment, the people who are reacting to stress by dissociating from those emotional reactions are actually more depressed, even though they still say they feel about the same amount of sadness, and they wouldn't spontaneously report, oh yeah, and also I'm dissociating right now. And so we can actually see that there's something to learn about what it means to be well in the face of sadness versus perhaps in a less wholesome state, an unwholesome state in the face of sadness, by peeking sort of below the hood of the car, you're looking inside people's brains and seeing, well, how is the sadness represented? If it's represented completely conceptually to the exclusion of momentary updating, that seems like it's really bad for you. And the final thing I think that we're sort of moving towards is as we get better at measuring things like, oh, body awareness, how you measure body awareness in the brain, or how you measure, you know, the effect of labeling experience in the brain, or how you measure meta-awareness in the brain, we can start to actually put these pieces of measurement together to test more complex theoretical models, right? And we don't have to come up with these models as scientists. This is where this is such an amazing opportunity. There are really rich descriptions of mechanistic models of what's supposed to happen in contemplative practice. And here's my own sort of stumbling understanding of, Chris reading the Visuddhimagga, that you have this kind of like awareness of feelings. And then that leads you to having greater expertise and familiarity that lets you label experience efficiently. And then that labeling gives you sort of these anchors that lead to meta-awareness. And then that meta-awareness leads to insights about yourself and your own patterns of reactivity, and then eventually insights about the way everyone must be. And then you get to these deep insights, these metaphysical insights. And so I don't think, you know, we're quite at the metaphysical insight measurement in the fMRI yet, but we can measure something like the ability to represent what's happening in your body from moment to moment. Right? And we're getting pretty good at measuring the effects of labeling and getting better at measuring meta-awareness. So then we can test, do you need this one piece of body awareness before you can have really improve your labeling and then have meta-awareness? And does that lead to a health benefit? So as we get better at sort of figuring out even what the pieces are, we can then use a scientific method to test how they fit together. And sometimes that will just validate what we already know from the contemplative canons. And sometimes it may challenge it and say, actually, we thought we really needed body awareness, but it turns out just labeling's fine. And so that may actually push back a bit against what you think is the necessary minimum requirements. And I think it's just a really exciting time to be doing this sort of research, and hopefully at least it sort of whets your palate for the types of ways we can try to use neuroscience to help deepen our understandings of what you already know are valuable contemplative practices. And with that last caveat, we don't want to forget why we're doing all this. It's not just to show that we can light up the body awareness part of the brain, but eventually we want these things to hook up to real-world desired outcomes or values, to hold the practices accountable for the goals we think that they're trying to achieve in the long term. So thank you very much.
Thanks so much for that, Dr. Farb. The next speaker that I would like to introduce is Dr. Philippe Golden. Dr. Golden is a clinical Totally fine. Well, the next speaker I would like to introduce then is Dr. Sarah Lazar. Dr. Lazar is an associate researcher in the Department of Psychiatry at Massachusetts General Hospital, and also an assistant professor in psychology at Harvard Medical School. Her research focuses on the neuroscience of yoga and meditation and has been covered by the New York Times, CNN, and displayed at the Boston Museum of Science. And today, Dr. Lazar will be talking about the Buddhist contribution to scientific research on mental health. So please, let's welcome Dr. Sarah Lazar.
So before we jump into the science, I just wanted to address the title of this session, which is Mindfulness and Mental Health, the Buddhist and Scientific Approach, Two Paths, One Destination. So this second part of the question, Two Paths, One Destination, it's actually something that is frequently discussed in our field, and there's been a lot of debate about it. And so I just wanted to spend a minute talking about that. So there we go. So often in Buddhism, they use the metaphor of the mountain, right? That as we practice, our goal is to reach the top of the mountain. The idea being that up there we have a rarefied view of the world that's unencumbered, and that you can see all around us very easily. And I would argue that in therapy, they're not even trying to get close. That they, in therapy, we're very much just trying to get out of the weeds, right? Out of the woods, and to get a pretty good, decent, clear view, but really not trying to get to the top of the mountain. And it's a really important distinction, I think, because in therapy, so in meditation, the idea is that we de-identify from the sense of self, and we sort of shed the, a lot of aspects of our personality. And in psychotherapy, that's actually considered a pathological condition. And so, yeah. And so, and I think there are differences, right? There's actually depersonalization disorder, and that is different than stream entry. But there are some parallels. And most therapists just, you know, they don't have the tools to help someone transform properly, and they just don't want people to go there. And so really, you know, they're really just getting you to the foothills. This is advancing faster than I thought. So I would say that, this is where therapy is going. And then, as we heard this morning, the other big difference that, you know, there's right front mindfulness and wrong mindfulness, and right mindfulness includes, you know, all the Dharma as well as ethics. In fact, one of my teachers told me that, you know, practice begins with ethics, practice ends with ethics, and everything in between is ethics. And there's absolutely no ethics in any mindfulness-based clinical intervention. So I would argue that although, you know, the clinical programs are in the same general area as this Buddhist practice, that there really are very distinct paths going in very different directions. It's just something, you know, that's my two cents. So, okay. So today I wanted to talk to you... So there's been many contributions of mindfulness to mental health. So we heard this morning a little, from Norm about in the context of sadness and depression. And so I want to talk, we've done a little bit of research about in the context of pain, and so I want to show you some of that research. So there's two components to pain. So one component is the intensity and the quality of it. So, you know, is it tingling, throbbing, stabbing, that aspect of it, and how intense is it? And then the other part is the unpleasantness. So if I were to go around and hit all of you exactly the same, you would all say probably the same thing about in terms of the throbbing and the tingling sensations of it. And if we did it in just the right way, you'd all give it, say, like a 5 on a scale of 1 to 10. You know, if we did it just right, you'd all say, okay, it's about a 5 on a scale of 1 to 10. But although you would all agree on what it feels like, how you felt about it would be very, very different. Some of you would be like, eh, okay, you hit me, no big deal. Some of you would be like, oh my God, that really hurt. Oh my God, I didn't like that. Don't do that again. And we know that these are very dissociable in terms of subjectively. And so if you often if you go to a pain clinic, they'll actually give you they'll ask you about each, and you'll see that there's no correlation between the intensity and the unpleasantness. We also know that in the brain there are two separate networks. So in blue, so this is basically your brain or a representation of your brain. So here's your brainstem. Let me do this. And then this is the front of the brain. Can everybody hear me okay? Yeah. This would be the front of the brain here, and over here, and this is the back of the brain. And so information comes in, you know, the punch would happen, and you would, the sensations would come into the brainstem, and then goes up the brainstem to the thalamus, then to sensory cortex, and also to the insula and the cingulate. And those are the regions that we heard about in the last talk. And those evaluate the intensity and the sensations of the stimulus, right? So again, the throbbing, the tingling, and how intense it is. But then this brown network is, and to some extent also the insula, evaluates the how unpleasant it is. And the brown network, the brown regions, that's the front of the brain. So you can think of the brain, basically the back half of the brain is a sensory part of the brain, and the front half of the brain is evaluation, but also control, thinking, planning, and, you know, in control of things. And what we know is that there's many different types of ways of regulating pain. So one is distraction, right? So if I, you know, flash something on the screen right before I hit you, and you're distracted, the pain won't be so bad. I can modify your expectations and tell you, oh, this isn't going to hurt so bad. We can talk about reappraisal, so the idea of, like, you know, no pain, no gain, right? Or, okay, if I give you the shot, you know, of immunization shot, this is going to help you prevent you from getting sick, then, you know, the pain won't seem so bad. Or I can do placebo. I could put a cream on, you know, just like some hand cream, but tell you, oh, there's something in this hand cream, and that's going to prevent you from feeling the pain. And what's interesting, with all four of those forms of emotion regulation or pain regulation, they all look the same in the brain. In all those cases, what happens is that brown network in the front of the brain literally shuts down the sensory part of the brain, right? And literally tells the front half of your brain, literally tells the back half of your brain, just don't feel it. So now we wondered, okay, what about meditation? We know with meditation, that if any of you have sat, you know that often when you sit quietly, your leg starts to go numb and your back starts to cramp up, and there's quite a bit of pain. And the instructions are, okay, just be aware of it, be mindful of it, and try to just bring your attention diffusely around the area, and to accept it and be okay with it. We thought, okay, well, so what does that look like in the brain? So what we did is we recruited 17 long-term practitioners of Vipassana meditation, mostly in the Goenka tradition. And on average, they had about 6,000 hours of practice. So these were not, monks. These were just, people like us who happen to practice a lot. And then there's 17 controls who are matched for age, gender, and education. And what we did is we put them in the MRI scanner, and it was actually a very mild electrical shock. So we didn't punch them, but we did give them a very mild electrical shock. And so during this first part in the green, they were told to either be just normal awareness or mindful awareness. And then there's a 40-second period during which they were shocked three times, just randomly during this. They didn't know when it was going to happen, and they would be shocked. And then at the end, they were told, they were given the unpleasantness and intensity ratings. So how intense was it on a scale of 1 to 10, and how unpleasant was it? And in terms of the self-report, what we see is, on the left is intensity, on the right is unpleasantness. So what we see is the controls, the dark gray is when they're just in a normal state, and then in the light gray is a mindful state. So the controls were sort of instructed in 5 minutes before they went to the scanner about how to be mindful, just to be aware. And you can see that neither intensity nor the unpleasantness really changes, because they don't really know what they're doing yet. But for the mindfulness practitioners, there's not much change in intensity, a little bit, but not much. But there's a big, significant change in the unpleasantness. So while they're in the meditative state, while they're just observing it and being mindful of it, it just, they said, okay, they felt it, but it just didn't, it didn't bother them so much. Well, this is self-report. What about the brain? Oops. Okay, so this is just to remind us that the back of the brain is sensory, the front of the brain is cognitive control. So here, this is looking at our brain from the top down. So these blue areas, that's part of the brown network, the executive control network. And what we see is that in the mindfulness practitioners, at baseline, they have, so in the normal state, they have activity in the front of the brain. But during the mindfulness state, they're actually turning off this brown network, right? They're turning off the front of the brain, the executive part of the brain. And conversely, this is your insula. That's one of the sensory parts of the brain, is actually getting turned up, right? So this is the exact opposite of what we're seeing with placebo and all these other forms of pain control, that the front of the brain is turning off and the sensory part of the brain is getting turned on. And they're actually, so this is consistent with self-report, right? So they're not trying to control it. They're not trying to, make it feel worse or make it feel less painful. They're actually going into it. They're sensing it more. They're more aware of the sensory experience. And yet they're saying that it's not painful or it's not as unpleasant. And so this is really, as Norm was saying, it really helps us understand that they're not just saying, oh, yeah, it doesn't feel that bad, that they really are experiencing it in a very different way, and also helps explain to people how it is different, and which is really important. And so now this study, we've done it. There's been 5 other groups that have done similar studies, and we've all found more or less the same thing, that the front of the brain gets turned off and the back of the brain gets turned on. In one of the studies, they compared it to placebo and to control. So they actually had, this was actually a 1 week program. So people were randomized to 4 conditions. So one condition was real meditation. One condition was sham meditation, which is where they were told, okay, we're going to teach you how to meditate. They didn't actually teach them anything. They just sort of talked for a while, then said, okay, sit and meditate. So people sort of sat there. didn't know what they were doing, you know, so that was, they thought they were meditating. The other group, like I said, was given a fake cream and told, okay, this cream has lidocaine in it, which is, you know, nothing. It was just hand cream. And another group read books. And so again, what we see is in terms of intensity on the left, that so the placebo did indeed work, right? So giving them the fake lidocaine cream did reduce their intensity a little bit. But both the sham meditation and the real meditation decreased intensity. But the biggest impact was on the unpleasantness, right? So the real meditation had the biggest impact and a bigger impact on either reading books or the lidocaine, the fake lidocaine cream. So it really does suggest that it's more effective than these other methods of dealing with pain. And that was really cool was that naloxone does not alter the effect. Okay. So naloxone is a drug which blocks the opioid system. And what's really interesting is that the other four methods of pain control are all blocked by naloxone. So if I give you this cream and you believe that it really does have something important in it that's going to block your pain, but I first give you naloxone, that cream no longer works. But what we see is that it does still work. I'm going up here. It does still work with meditation. So it really suggests that meditation is working through a mechanism that's independent of the opioid system. And given the current crisis with opioids, this is really important because it really suggests that there's a different way of helping people deal with pain. And then the final bit of data that I was going to show you is this, which was from another study where they looked at years of meditation and they looked at the correlation between activity in the front of the brain and the correlation between the activity in the back of the brain. And what they found is that the disconnect between the two was correlated with the amount of experience. So the more practice you had, the better you were at disassociating the front of the brain and the back of the brain. And so the better able you were at, you know, sort of being able to feel it without trying to control it. And so that's it. Thank you very much.
Okay, and so now we will hear from Dr. Philippe Golden. Dr. Golden is a clinical neuroscientist and associate professor at UC Davis. He teaches and conducts research in the areas of health promotion, clinical psychology, and cognitive affective neuroscience. And today he will be talking about the science of mindfulness in mental health. A warm round of applause for Dr. Golden.
Okay, great honor to be here. About all of you, thanks for being here. Thanks to the organizers. So mostly what we do in science is a lot of hard work, and then we have the great pleasure, like this moment, to tell a story. So I'm going to share a little bit of what we're doing in my lab, but I also, in this case, I'm going to be a little different. I'm going to ask you to participate, and I'm going to guide you in very brief contemplations so that you can bring your own experience, and then we can look at what's happening in the brain together. So right this moment, you don't have to change anything. Just shift your attention to your breath and literally slow down and notice the sensations of your breath, the quality of your mind. No evaluation, no judgment. That's it. So, the motivation for this talk and much of our research, and I think we speak for many of us, both in clinical and in contemplative practice, et cetera, is really to go from left to right, from a state of mind that is full of angst, suffering, confusion, self-doubt, to a mind that is really vibrant, elevated, innovative, lucid, you know, lucid. But how do we do that? Well, this talk is one half of two talks. The other half of this path I'll share with you tomorrow. But this is just a kind of an idea of way of structuring this. Most practices, be it psychotherapy or contemplative practices, really start with attention. So what we know is that there are many different factors that influence attention. They could be top down or bottom up. Did I sleep well last night, etc., or not? Am I motivated to pay attention? Well, interestingly, when we are not paying attention to what's important in the moment, and this is a very nice study that was very influential from science, basically showing that when people's minds are not on task, but instead wandering off, actually the mind tends to gravitate towards things that are unpleasant. So this is very important to understand, that when the mind is not in a more focused state, it tends to drift into states of mind that are not happy. So moving further, so what? Does this have a neurobiological effect? So a friend of mine, Alyssa Eppel in San Francisco, UCSF, found that people, as you see in the red circle, people who report their mind wandering a lot actually have much shorter telomeres. These are the caps on our chromosomes that is a biological marker of when that cell is going to die. And not only that, when we are going to die. So stress, negative thinking, inability to deal with conflict actually begins to reduce. And in this case, she found that people who reported lots of mind wandering, these caps on the chromosomes, the telomeres got shorter, 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 shorter. So this is a mind chromosome body neurobiological relationship. Very fascinating. So how do we begin to shift? We learn how to focus our attention, and then we become aware of emotions, emotion awareness. So just for a moment, shift your attention to the sole of your left foot. Just notice if there are any gross or subtle sensations. Well, if we extend that further, if we had time, to emotions, different emotional states, and I love this study. And what basically they did is they asked thousands of people to create a map of where they feel sensations in their whole body, in different parts of the body, for different specific emotions. The body is a continuous source of information. Sensory experience is a source of information about how we and others, empathy, are doing from moment to moment. So you can see there's a lot of differentiation of different specific states, mental states. So how do we begin to understand this neurobiologically or in the brain? Well, in a given moment, this is also very important, Tanya Singer. Body awareness is very important because it turns out that research is showing that that body awareness is a basis for emotional awareness. Emotional awareness is a basis for having empathic resonance or concern for others. And this is a study by Tanya Singer, one of my favorite neuroscientists in Germany, in the world, showing, and this is also very influential, showing that when people are in a state of mind of recognizing the pain and suffering in others, there's a very reliable network of brain regions that are activated that can be replicated again and again. So when you really are in a state of mind that is recognizing the pain and suffering, physical, even emotional, of others, we can actually see it in the brain, in this network, which is called the salience network. More about that probably tomorrow. So here, the brain has been sculpted through evolution to be exquisitely sensitive from moment to moment to pick up signals, real or imagined. So even if I go boom and there's a threat, within milliseconds, there's a whole cascade of activity, in this case, that shifts your affective or your emotional state within milliseconds. And we can actually see that in the brain in a distributed network that supports the ability to have emotions. And it's called emotional reactivity. Now, but no one has ever seen an emotion. And that's why you're right. These are all the things that we measure to try to infer the emotion state of a person. And you can see there are many different ways to do that. So once we've now become more skillful, masterful at knowing how to focus attention, being aware of our body sensory state, the emotions that we're experiencing, what do you do next? Well, be it contemplative practice or psychotherapy, we teach different ways of regulating, modulating your emotions. So I actually came from a lab that really focuses on emotion regulation. So what happens is when you have emotions, even before we're consciously aware, it's sending a bottom-up signal saying, hey, other parts of the brain, please come online and help out. In blue, cognitive control, as was mentioned earlier, different ways and aspects of shifting and regulating your attention. What am I focusing on? And when this system is working well, what you see in blue, cognitive control areas, attention regulation areas, exert a top-down influence to either increase emotion, decrease emotion, modulate the emotions. In human animals that we are, there are at least two and probably more other kinds of psychological functions. The way we view ourselves influences how this system works. The language, the inner self-talk, which we actually can see in the brain, influences how skillful or not people are at modulating their emotions. So the whole idea is, can you become masterful at regulating these different psychological functions that already exist in the brain, they're instantiated in the brain, and go from angst, pain, to becoming masterful, skillful. Meditation, bhavana in Sanskrit, to cultivate specific qualities and to gain familiarity, insight into how this research lab, which is free, you don't need a grant, this mind-body actually works, which I love to think. So mindfulness here is like the flagpole. Doesn't matter how turbulent the outer and inner world is, it's a steadiness, a solidity, a ground. So here are just a couple of things that to contrast two of these two different approaches. Cognitive behavioral therapy, which is the gold standard form of psychotherapy to treat anxiety, depression, etc. And mindfulness meditation, which now is gaining huge traction as a way to help introduce people to specific windows into their mind to help reduce stress, depression, anxiety, change. And you can see how these are contrasting. I did this as an exercise to really think about what's different in the features of these two different approaches. So, just for a moment, close your eyes. And I'm going to guide you for a moment. And I want you to be the scientist that you are and notice what happens as I say this. Notice what happens to your body. I'm not okay the way I am. Something is wrong with me. People can see that I am anxious. I will never change. Just notice how that makes you feel. Some people, that is their experience 24/7. Maybe not when they're sleeping. So now that you can open your eyes at using fMRI to probe under the hood of a car, so to speak, to go actually under the skull and look in the brain, we can see reliably set patterns of brain imaging patterns of different networks that support conceptual self-view, self-referential processing, emotional reactivity. The brain, part of doing brain imaging in neuroscience is to allow the brain to manifest patterns and forms and shapes that help us understand. So given that we now can see when a target, which is these different regions that have to do with distorted view of self, overuse of language, maybe amygdala, emotional reactivity, what do we do next? Amygdala, in that red circle. So I'll pass that, but I'm going to go just directly to a finding, which is looking at this right dorsal amygdala. We did a study with people with anxiety disorders, and we did fMRI pre and post. And here what we did under the black bar, REACT, is giving them their own negative self-beliefs about themselves, spinning, spinning, spinning. And that, you can see, is the black solid bar. And what you see is that it actually increases over time. And then we give them the cue to shift attention to the sensations of their breath, just at the tip of the nostrils. A couple of things I want to point out. Fast forward 3 months later, after 2 months of mindfulness meditation practice, the first circle, there's a peak. People who do mindfulness meditation may actually experience greater emotional reactivity initially, followed by a rapid return to baseline, greater flexibility. So now, just for a moment, close your eyes again. And again, this notion that I'm not okay the way I am. Something is fundamentally flawed. Now shift to reappraising that, reinterpreting that. That's just the neurons in the mind producing thoughts. Nothing more real than just neurons firing. It's just a thought. It's temporary. It's not any more real than anything else. Now open your eyes. So that's called cognitive reappraisal. We can also see how that specific strategy is instantiated in the brain. We actually have very reliable patterns that show the prefrontal cortex, as was mentioned in the previous talk, that really demonstrate cognitive control, language, logic, reasoning, perspective taking. You can actually see that manifesting, those qualities instantiated in the brain. So now again, click, click, click. Close your eyes. One more thing. We're almost done. I'm fundamentally flawed. I'll never be masterful. I'm extremely limited. Why am I so stressed? Now shift to just leaning back and simply noticing for the next few seconds anything that appears in the mind or in the body without grasping and without pushing away. Simply hovering awareness, dropping in, and noticing, observing, being with. No energy or effort to push or hold on. Now open your eyes. So for lack of a better term, decentering, radical acceptance. And we can actually now begin to see that in the brain. This is with 35 healthy adults. And now to actually look at where in the brain pattern is that similar to cognitive reappraisal? Where is it different? And how can we distinguish between those? So when a person enters a state of decentering from something that's intense emotionally emotion inducing, what can we see? So the punchline here is, come on, computer. I like to call it WD-40. So that when we do these contemplative practices, when you do psychotherapy, it loosens up the grit of these overused neural pathways just enough to be able to allow different techniques and learning to open up the mind. One insight and wisdom arises from that, and I simply want to say thank you for your attention.
So I just want to thank all our speakers, Dr. Farb, Dr. Lazor, and Dr. Golden, so much for sharing your insights. And I'd also like to invite all three of you to have a seat. And now we are going to have a Q&A session. So if there are any questions, there are, I believe, microphones set up. I think there's one gentleman over there who has a question. There it is.
I have a question for each of you, actually. One for each. I don't know your names. So the first speaker, my question is, how do you respond to the second speaker's mentioned issue of ethics not being a part of mindfulness-based interventions? The question for the second person is the question... Okay, one question. Go ahead. I can't remember the second one yet anyway, so give me a second. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's a super important question. So one thing I'd like to point out, though, is that people aren't showing up to courses without any kind of moral compass or ethical system that they're hoping to operate under. And so when we help someone to destabilize a deeply entrenched reactive pattern, it's not necessarily the case that we're wiping the slate completely clean and they don't already have a sense of the kind of person they would like to be or they don't already have a sense of right or wrong. It might not be the same as the as like the precepts of a particular tradition, but they probably already have some of those ethics in mind, and they're having trouble realizing that in their lives because of the habits, the conditioning they have. So the idea that it's completely bankrupt to teach the mindfulness without also teaching ethics, I think, is an overstatement, because people come in already as ethical beings for the most part, though some people might have more or less clarity with that. And for someone who doesn't have a lot of clarity or has an upbringing where they weren't really exposed to an ethical system that they endorse, yeah, then there's something missing, right? You're destabilizing patterns and you're not telling them what to replace it with. So I think it really would depend on the person coming into training, how much they also need training in developing an ethical system for themselves. And the other thing I would say is I don't think it's really the case that there are no ethics being taught in a mindfulness course. They're just not in the manual. So the teachers are supposed to embody these qualities and virtues, and this is why it's very contentious in the secular mindfulness movement how much a teacher needs to practice themselves before they're able to go and communicate the teaching to someone else, because there may be an implicit teaching of curiosity, kindness, equanimity, acceptance, that's still very profound. Now, is that as good as actually putting it in the manual? Like, if we want that there to be in every course, no, I agree, it's not as good. It should be there. But the tension is between the benefits of giving a formal ethical system and what doors that might actually close in terms of where you can transmit the knowledge. So if you go to a hospital or a primary grade school in a predominantly Catholic region and say, I want to teach this course, it's going to help with attention, and it's also going to introduce some really, you know, great Buddhist ethics, it might actually limit your ability to translate those teachings, or at least part of the teachings. So I guess the real challenge is to demonstrate that the teachings are ineffective without ethics, to then have a justification for mandating ethics in the teaching, is sort of what I would say from the skeptical Westerner's perspective. But I don't think things are completely bankrupt if you're not formally teaching ethics, because many people do know the kinds of qualities they want in their lives. They just don't know how to get out of their own way in some ways. So that would be my sort of take on it for now. But it's by no means a well-resolved issue. And it may be the case that we can, like, empirically demonstrate that if you're not also teaching compassion, you only get, like, 50% of the effect, or you get none of the effect, right? Or it's not lasting. And if we can show that, then that would justify then including ethical modules into these manualized teaching programs.
And also, we conducted one empirical study, a randomized controlled trial with Shauna Shapiro and Huda Jaziri, myself, of graduate students, and got either a standard MBSR course for 2 months or something else for 2 months. And then we measured changes in ethical decision-making, moral decision-making. Not trained in the course explicitly, but we actually found a significant increase. Now, for all of you who are not scientists, never trust one study. Never. Don't listen to journalists, please. Never. Only replication, multiple times in different labs done by different scientists. But at least it's one little piece that, and this is conscious self-reported decision making in this kind of vignette situation. So that's just a simple single study hint that something in mindfulness practice might actually open up ethical prowess or ability spontaneously, which is actually a whole other side.
That's great. Thank you. I ask the other two questions. You want to ask one?
While I'm listening, I was thinking about you try to explain the front sides of the brain and the right side of the behind side of the brain. I was curious about to learn about the left side of the brain and the right side of the brain. Do we have any kind of a drastic difference in the brain, left brain and the right brain?
Women have much greater connectivity between left and right than do men, biologically. And that's a good thing.
What is the
we men are just trying to catch up with them across the entire lifespan. And we don't. It takes a long time.
Yes, there are. We know that some functions are more on the left, some functions are more on the right. Meditation seems to impact both, but seems to be more on the right side of the brain. But there's definitely very little is pure right or pure left. There's lots of connections between the two. So a little bit depends on the task, the person, the conditions?
As well as age. People who are right-handed have much more activity in the left hemisphere for language processing when they're younger. But as you get older, there's a Harold model, but as you get older, it becomes more bilateral. So there's actually a change over time in how functions are instantiated in either one hemisphere or across hemispheres.
Thank you.
Yeah. My name is Nihal Vikramasurya. I have two questions, but I believe maybe both are related together. So I believe maybe Dr. Ferb and Dr. Golding, or maybe even the other professor, will be answering. So I don't want to direct at any one of you. So one thing is, so I heard about when to become mindful and how to become mindful. And the other question is around nature of the mind. Mind is always wandering. So the first question is when to become mindful and how to become mindful. Because then I do practice meditation and I try my best to be living in the present moment. But at the same time, but I work in an organization, then I have to prepare for presentations, which is going to happen in 2 weeks from now or 1 month from now. So then I prepare myself, and then I have to visualize what kind of audience is it, then what kind of questions they are going to ask, then I rehearse my presentation, then visualizing that environment. Then all of a sudden I feel, am I breaking the rule of living in the present? So that then, if I do that, then I feel that I'm not trying to make my mind to be creative and then activate the creative aspect of the mind. So that is one thing. And the other thing is about the nature of the mind. Then as my experience, mind is wandering. Mind has a habit of wandering. And then when I do meditation and I go into deep meditation, so I bring that and then try to focus on a limited thing or limited area or about my breath. But all of a sudden, my mind starts wandering again. Then again I call back. And then again I'm thinking, am I doing something wrong? Because mind's habit is wandering. Like a child wants to play around. So I'm not asking the child, don't play, come and sit here. So I'm getting confused, so I just want some answers from you.
Deep meditation.
I'm not joking, actually, I really like that. Just one brief thing. At Google, we developed meditation training programs at Google, and the Google employees are always like, yeah, we love it, we want to do it, da, 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 but we're too busy. I'm like, how many times do you drink a cup of tea or coffee per day? Oh, how many times do you go to the bathroom? How many times do you wash your hands? How many times do you open a door? Oh, each of those moments you could use as a basis for shifting. So I like to say if you're a jazz musician, you're always listening to sounds. If you're like a jazzy, contemplative practitioner, you use anything and everything as a moment to train the mind. There's nothing that is not the basis for training the mind. In the same way that you mentioned yesterday, anything that appears in the mind, you could see it, love it, appreciate it. So even if the mind wandering, there's nothing necessarily bad about it. It depends on the context. In fact, some data tomorrow showing that 2 months of compassion meditation, there's an increase in mind wandering to pleasant thoughts.
Got it.
That might not be a bad thing.
Okay,
that's
thank
one
you.
Part. But I don't know. What do you think? What do you think?
And so this morning, they talked about right mindfulness and wrong mindfulness, and the third monk talked about how, you know, you could be mindful of the past or the future. And so when you're planning your talk it's fine to be, because in this moment you're planning what you're going to do 3 months from now. So that's fine. It's not going to lead to enlightenment, but it's fine to be mindful, and you can develop mindfulness of the present moment planning the future moment, if that makes sense.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I got the answers. Thank you.
Okay, I know there's someone over here who's been waiting very patiently. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Davarin. I'm a physician from Michigan here in the United States. And I have a question for Dr. Lazar. I'm a primary care internal medicine physician, and one of the things that we struggle to help patients with is chronic pain, which for some of the folks in the audience, it's a little different physiologically from these experiences of acute pain you might get from a stimulation and so on. So for folks who are having what we call centralized chronic pain, I'm curious as to whether your understanding of the non-opioid essence of your findings and some of these brain effects it has information in terms of chronic pain management. And as a corollary to that, is there any information on specific types of medication practice that may be more effective for modulating particularly the centralized and chronic pain components?
With respect to variations of mindfulness programs that are created, so Vidyamala Bartsch, Breathworks, UK, they have a variation of the mindfulness-based stress reduction program specifically for pain. She's a paraplegic, and she developed it over the past 30 years, and they have some nice preliminary data from a few hundred people. They have 50 teachers all over the UK. That's a program specifically for chronic pain, but it's not been tested against an active comparison or pharmacology, so there's not hardcore data supporting it. But what do you think about the chronic pain?
And also, I mean, so John Kabat-Zinn actually, the original version of MBSR was actually specifically for chronic pain patients. And then he realized it's helping all the other symptoms, so he expanded it. But originally it was specifically for chronic pain. And there's been other programs, too, for chronic pain. So definitely it is effective. It doesn't do much for the pain. Again, it's more the attitude towards the pain and the ability to deal with the pain, which is important. And no one has done imaging yet of chronic pain, as far as I'm aware of. And so
We have an fMRI study right now of a randomized controlled trial for people with chronic lower back pain. However, all of them are on a mishmash of different drugs, which makes it really difficult. But it's cognitive behavioral therapy versus mindfulness meditation versus no treatment at all. But the data, we haven't analyzed the data yet because it's still being collected. But there's definitely, most pain clinics really need to incorporate contemplative practice, both for the clinicians, because, you know, dealing with people with chronic pain is really difficult, and for the people who are suffering. But that needs to be supported. To maintain a practice in the context of pain is really difficult for most lay people, newbies.
Thank you. So I'm going to turn our attention to our live streaming audience. We have one question.
Okay, this is a question from Tony from Cleveland, Ohio. He has a question regarding mindfulness and mental health. By practicing almost 2 years per day, or 2 hours per day, my memory and the way my brain stores information has changed. My brain has become more non-stick, and I can't remember much of what happened in the past or in the last few days. I'm an engineer, and this is adversely affecting my work. Have any of your speakers performed a study on the effect of mindfulness on memory and how the brain changes in this respect? Thank you.
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think it highlights the idea that if you have a contemplative practice that's supposed to be really powerful, you can't hold that as being true, that you have this powerful transformative practice, and also say, but there's no way anything bad could happen. It would be like saying, like, I have this power saw, but there's no way it could do anything bad. It's just, it only makes good things. So you have this tool, right? And then the question is, what are you using the tool for? And one sort of big challenge we have now is that we only have like three practices out of a huge family of contemplative practices that are widely taught in the West. And part of what I was trying to communicate is we need to get better at understanding exactly what each practice is going to be sort of expected to do. So if a person's practice is always coming to the present moment and sort of in some ways devaluing or at least not rewarding any sort of movement into memory formation, into rehearsing, scheduling, to things that take you out of the present moment, guess what you're going to get really good at? You can get really good at being present, and you're going to atrophy the systems that help you keep things in order from past and present and future. So if
what's occurring then is a sense of dysfunction, and you're using, so I'm using this saw, and I'm like, ah, my deck looks pretty good, but now I'm starting to find holes in my deck, like in my back porch. I'll just saw some more. Oh no, now there's more holes in my back porch. Like, I would advise, like, stop doing just the practice that's robbing you of memory. Stop doing a practice that's sort of antithetical to using memory, and maybe try taking on a mindfulness of scheduling or mindfulness of what I need to do in my next meeting practice. This is the other gentleman mentioned. The one thing that is inescapable at the brain is it's going to develop habits based on what you do, and it's going to forget to do how to do things that you don't practice. So if the complaint is, like, I spend so much time practicing being in the present moment that I can't use memory very much anymore, what about a memory mindfulness practice, right? What about mindfully rehearsing a schedule for the day or a list for the day or something like that and seeing how that changes things? So just as we have to kind of try to be open that we don't know what's going on and we're going to try to experiment, I think from that first-person practitioner perspective, like Philippe said, you have your own lab. And if you're always running, like, memory dissolution studies and present moment studies and that's not getting what you want, then run a study about improving memory in your own lab that involves doing some mindful memory exercises, right? There's rich analytic traditions about mindful problem-solving and visualizing problems that aren't at all apparent in, like, mindfulness-based stress reduction, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. And so people can take away from what they're exposed to in terms of the practices here that's all you could be doing with your attention. That's all you could be doing with meditation. But I guess the take-home message would be, if you're doing a practice and it's making your life worse, stop.
Go find a teacher.
Find a teacher to at least explain, like, why this might be happening or what else you could do, right?
Okay, I think we have time for maybe one more question.
Okay, my question is directed towards everyone, basically, on the panel. So I've been noticing as a layperson, as someone who's not really a scientist of any kind, mostly a social scientist, I've noticed that there's a lot of focus on these days when it comes to mindfulness-based practice and mental health on, for those who are on the depressive side of the mood spectrum. And I'm just curious to know if any of you can provide any insight as to the effects of mindfulness practice or contemplative practice and its implications on redirecting an individual to baseline. Is there any research into that at the moment or any comments that you could provide?
On depression specifically, you're asking?
For those who are on the other side of the spectrum, let's say those who experience mania, hypomania, bipolar.
Yeah, no, we did a study with bipolar, but for depression, though. I'd say probably yoga might be better because you want to be grounded, right? And meditation tends to... that would be my little bit of, so like a Tai Chi or something like that, that's really slow, really balanced, really, that's, just anecdotally, I've heard that might be useful. And when we did a study with bipolar, we included yoga first, and they seem to really like that. So that would be my one suggestion.
Yeah, I think the clinical literature on mania and bipolar disorders is much weaker. Like, there's way fewer studies than there are for things like depression or anxiety. So you have to sort of, it's pioneer days, even more so than for, pain or depression. But seated within, even the currently offered mindfulness courses, there really are multiple movements you try to make with your attention. So some of them are explicitly, like, centering, focusing on one thing and really letting yourself become absorbed until you sort of relax and settle. And there's other practices that are sort of, like, expansive, like, sense more things, take on, like, let more things in that you wouldn't normally let in. Open up all the sense gates and let more information than you're normally, that you'd be habitually filtering out. And so this is not evidence-based, but I would suspect that in things like in mania, which are disorders of, in some ways, clinging to too much positive experience coming in, trying to open up more to the feeling of being excited and how wonderful it is to be manic might not be the most skillful thing to do. Whereas a practice that lets someone calm down and ground themselves a little bit might be okay. And there's a bit of a stigma, at least in my own experience, against, like, relaxation as an outcome of meditation. But it's, again, what do you want the meditation to do? Like, if you want the meditation to treat mania, you don't want to bring someone into deeper contact with the reinforcing nature of mania. Like, get really feel how good it is to, like, have unprotected sex or whatever it is that the mania is driving the person to do. You might want to offer a meditation that acts as a tonic to that. So that would be my intuition. But that's not qualified. It's not like there's a big evidence base to suggest that. It's just you could train your mind to be less reactive and clinging onto positive experience, just as you could train your mind not to spiral downwards into self-deprecating thoughts. But the practice has to target that.
Thank you. So we just have one last question over here.
So a quick question for one for Dr. Fab and one for Dr. Laza. I'm a neurologist from McMaster University. About your study on the functional MRI of the judging and sensing, was that as scientists we are always skeptical about non-randomized trial? Was that a randomized control trial that you did with meditation? Was there any sham meditation when you showed the changes in the cortical areas, any randomization, or was there anything?
So there's different levels of randomization quality. I would say it was in that sort of mid to lower level, but there was randomization. So participants are all interested in doing a meditation course, and they're randomized either being a weightless control, so there is, you don't control for them having expectation of change, versus actually doing the course. So we end up testing a group of people who've just completed the course compared to a group of people who are about to do the course, and they're randomized into those conditions. Not as good as giving them, like, sham meditation or an active control to control for expectancy, but, yeah, much better than not randomizing.
Okay. All right, yeah. Great. And for Dr. Lanza, you made the in the study of the pain study, there was the insular cortex showed some changes. Was that the same results of the four other studies you mentioned? That was really interesting. The four other studies you mentioned, there was same changes in the frontal cortex to
the ones with the placebo
compared
and the...
Yeah?
Yeah, they didn't include imaging, I don't think.
They didn't include imaging?
But they found the same general idea, though, that there's increase in the sensory cortex and decrease in the front of the brain.
Okay, was it in the insular cortex?
Right. I don't remember if it's insular or not. One of the other studies found more of the thalamus. And then Fadel Zeidan, I forget where he finds, actually. I should know that, but I don't. But yeah. I think it was either sensory cortex or insular. I forget exactly.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much to all three of you, Dr. Farb, Dr. Golden, and Dr. Lazar. Round of applause. And thank you for all the questions as well.